Chapter 80. Above decks, on the Mendacium, Langdon gripped the polished teak railing, steadied his wavering legs, and tried to catch his breath. The sea air had grown colder, and the roar of low-flying commercial jets told him they were nearing the Venice airport. "There are some things I have to tell you about Miss Brooks." Beside him at the railing, the provost and Dr. Sinsky remained silent but attentive, giving him a moment to get his bearings. What they had told Langdon downstairs had left him so disoriented and upset that Sinsky had brought him outside for some air. The sea air was bracing, and yet Langdon felt no clearer in his head. All he could do was stare vacantly down at the churning wake of the ship, trying to find a shred of logic to what he had just heard. According to the provost, Sienna Brooks and Bertrand Zobrist had been long-time lovers. They were active together in some kind of underground transhumanist movement. Her full name was Felicity Sienna Brooks, but she also went by the code name FS-2080, which had something to do with her initials and the year of her 100th birthday. None of it makes any sense. "I knew Sienna Brooks through a different source," the provost had told Langdon, "and I trusted her. So when she came to me last year and asked me to meet a wealthy potential client, I agreed. That prospect turned out to be Bertrand Zobrist. He hired me to provide him a safe haven where he could work undetected on his masterpiece. I assumed he was developing a new technology that he didn't want pirated, or maybe he was performing some cutting-edge genetic research that was in conflict with the WHO's ethics regulations. I didn't ask questions. But believe me, I never imagined he was creating a plague." Langdon had only been able to nod vacantly, bewildered. "Zobrist was a Dante fanatic," the provost continued, "and he therefore chose Florence as the city in which he wanted to hide. So my organization set him up with everything he needed: a discreet lab facility with living quarters, various aliases and secure communication avenues, and a personal attaché who oversaw everything from his security to buying food and supplies. Zobrist never used his own credit cards or appeared in public, so he was impossible to track. We even provided him disguises, aliases, and alternate documentation for traveling unnoticed." He paused, "which he apparently did when he placed the Soljeblon bag." Sinsky exhaled, making little effort to hide her frustration.
"The WHO has been trying to keep tabs on him since last year, but he seemed to have vanished off the face of the earth."
"Even hiding from Sienna," the provost said.
"I'm sorry?" Langdon glanced up, clearing the knot in his throat.
"I thought you said they were lovers."
"They were, but he cut her off suddenly when he went into hiding. Even though Sienna was the one who sent him to us, my agreement was with Zobrist himself, and part of our deal was that when he disappeared, he would disappear from the whole world, including Sienna. Apparently, after he went into hiding, he sent her a farewell letter revealing that he was very ill, would be dead in a year or so, and didn't want her to see him deteriorate."
"Zobrist abandoned Sienna?"
"Sienna tried to contact me for information," the provost said, "but I refused to take her calls. I had to respect my client's wishes."
2 weeks ago," Sinsky continued, "Zobrist walked into a bank in Florence and anonymously rented a safe deposit box. After he left, our watch list got word that the bank's new facial recognition software had identified the disguised man as Bertrand Zobrist. My team flew to Florence, and it took a week to locate his safe house, which was empty. But inside we found evidence that he had created some kind of highly contagious pathogen and hidden it somewhere else."
Sinsky paused.
"We were desperate to find him. The following morning, before sunrise, we spotted him walking along the Arno, and we immediately gave chase. That's when he fled up the Badia Tower and jumped to his death."
"He may have been planning to do that anyway,"
the provost added. He was convinced he did not have long to live.
As it turned out, Sinsky said, Sienna had been searching for him as well. Somehow she found out that we had mobilized to Florence, and she tailed our movements, thinking we might have located him. Unfortunately, she was there in time to see Zobrist jump.
Sinsky sighed.
I suspect it was very traumatic for her to watch her lover and mentor fall to his death.
Langdon felt ill, barely able to comprehend what they were telling him. The only person in this entire scenario whom he trusted was Sienna. And these people were telling him that she was not who she claimed to be? No matter what they said, he could not believe Sienna would condone Zobrist's desire to create a plague. Or would she? Would you kill half the population today, Sienna had asked him, in order to save our species from extinction? Langdon felt a chill.
Once Zobrist was dead, Sinsky explained, I used my influence to force the bank to open Zobrist's safe deposit box, which ironically turned out to contain a letter to me, along with a strange little device.
The projector, Langdon ventured.
Exactly. His letter said he wanted me to be the first to visit Ground Zero, which nobody would ever find without following his map of hell.
Langdon pictured the modified Botticelli painting that shone out of the tiny projector. The provost added, Zobrist had contracted me to deliver to Dr. Sinsky the contents of the safe deposit box, but not until after tomorrow morning. When Dr. Sinsky came into possession of it early, we panicked and took action, trying to recover it in accordance with our client's wishes. Sinsky looked at Langdon.
I didn't have much hope of understanding the map in time, so I recruited you to help me. Are you remembering any of this now?
Langdon shook his head.
We flew you quietly to Florence, where you had made an appointment with someone you thought could help.
Ignazio Busoni.
You met with him last night, Sinsky said, and then you disappeared. We thought something had happened to you.
And in fact, the provost said, something did happen to you. In an effort to recover the projector, we had an agent of mine named Vianta tell you from the airport. She lost you somewhere around the Piazza della Signoria, he scowled. Losing you was a critical error, and Vianta had the nerve to blame it on a bird. I'm sorry? A cooing dove. By Vianta's account, she was in perfect position watching you from a darkened alcove when a group of tourists passed. She said a dove suddenly cooed loudly from a window box over her head, causing the tourists to stop and block Vianta in. By the time she could slip back into the alley, you were gone. He shook his head in disgust. Anyway, she lost you for several hours. Finally, she picked up your trail again, and by this time you had been joined by another man.
Ignazio, Langdon thought. He and I must have been exiting the Palazzo Vecchio with the mask.
She successfully tailed you both in the direction of the Piazza della Signoria, but the two of you apparently saw her and decided to flee, going in separate directions.
That makes sense, Langdon thought. Ignazio fled with the mask and hid it in the baptistry before he had a heart attack.
Then, Vianta made a terrible mistake, the provost said.
She shot me in the head?
No, she revealed herself too early. She pulled you in for interrogation before you actually knew anything. We needed to know if you had deciphered the map or told Dr. Sinsky what she needed to know. You refused to say a word. You said you would die first.
I was looking for a deadly plague. I probably thought you were mercenaries looking to obtain a biological weapon.
The ship's massive engine suddenly shifted into reverse, slowing the vessel as it neared the loading dock for the airport. In the distance, Langdon could see the nondescript hull of a C-130 transport plane fueling. The fuselage bore the inscription, World Health Organization. At that moment, Bruder arrived, his expression grim. I've just learned that the only qualified response team within 5 hours of the site is us, which means we're on our own.
Sinsky slumped. Coordination with local authorities?
Bruder looked wary. Not yet. That's my recommendation. We don't have an exact location at the moment, so there's nothing they could do. Moreover, a containment operation is well beyond the scope of their expertise, and we run the real risk of their doing more damage than good.
Primum non nocere,
Sinsky whispered with a nod, repeating the fundamental precept of medical ethics. First, do no harm.
Lastly, Bruder said, we still have no word on Sienna Brooks. He eyed the provost. Do you know if Sienna has contacts in Venice who might assist her?
It wouldn't surprise me, he replied. Zobrist had disciples everywhere, and if I know Sienna, she'll be using all available resources to carry out her directive.
You can't let her get out of Venice, Sinsky said. We have no idea what condition that Solublonde bag is currently in. If anyone discovers it, all that would be needed at this point is a slight touch to burst the plastic and release the contagion into the water.
There was a moment of silence as the gravity of the situation settled in. I'm afraid I've got more bad news, Langdon said. The gilded mosaic of holy wisdom. He paused. Sienna knows where it is. She knows where we're going.
What?
Sinsky's voice rose in alarm.
I thought you said you didn't have a chance to tell Sienna what you'd figured out. You said all you told her is that you were in the wrong country.
That's true, Langdon said. But she knew we were looking for the tomb of Enrico Dandolo. A quick web search can tell her where that is. And once she finds Dandolo's tomb, the dissolving canister can't be far away. The poem said to follow the sounds of trickling water to the sunken palace.
Damn it!
Bruder erupted and stormed off.
She'll never beat us there, the provost said. We have a head start.
Sinsky sighed heavily.
I wouldn't be so sure. Our transport is slow, and it appears Sienna Brooks is extremely resourceful.
As the Mendacium docked, Langdon found himself staring uneasily at the cumbersome C-130 on the runway. It barely looked airworthy and had no windows. I've been on this thing already? Langdon didn't remember a thing. Whether it was because of the movement of the docking boat or growing reservations about the claustrophobic aircraft, Langdon didn't know, but he was suddenly hit by an upsurge of nausea. He turned to Sinsky. I'm not sure I feel well enough to fly.
You're fine, she said. You've been through the ringer today, and of course, you've got the toxins in your body.
Toxins? Langdon took a wavering step backward. What are you talking about? Sinsky glanced away, clearly having said more than she intended.
Professor, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I've just learned that your medical condition is a bit more complicated than a simple head wound.
Langdon felt a spike of fear as he pictured the black flesh on Ferris's chest when the man collapsed in the basilica. What's wrong with me? Langdon demanded. Sinsky hesitated, as if uncertain how to proceed.
Let's get you onto the plane first.
Chapter 81. Located just east of the spectacular Frari Church, the Atelier Pietro Longhi has always been one of Venice's premier providers of historical costumes, wigs, and accessories. Its client list includes film companies and theatrical troupes, as well as influential members of the public who rely on the staff's expertise to dress them for Carnevale's most extravagant balls. The clerk was just about to lock up for the evening when the door jingled loudly. He glanced up to see an attractive woman with a blonde ponytail come bursting in. She was breathless, as if she'd been running for miles. She hurried to the counter, her brown eyes wild and desperate.
I want to speak to Giorgio Venci,
she had said, panting.
Don't we all, the clerk thought, but nobody gets to see the wizard.
Giorgio Venci, the atelier's chief designer, worked his magic from behind the curtain, speaking to clients very rarely and never without an appointment. As a man of great wealth and influence,
Giorgio was allowed certain eccentricities, including his passion for solitude. He dined privately, flew privately, and constantly complained about the rising number of tourists in Venice. He was not one who liked company.
"I'm sorry," the clerk said with a practiced smile. "I'm afraid Signor Venci is not here. Perhaps I can help you?"
"Giorgio's here," she declared. "His flat is upstairs. I saw his light on. I'm a friend. It's an emergency."
There was a burning intensity about the woman. "A friend," she claims.
"Might I tell Giorgio your name?"
The woman took a scrap of paper off the counter and jotted down a series of letters and numbers.
"Just give him this," she said, handing the clerk the paper. "And please hurry. I don't have much time."
The clerk hesitantly carried the paper upstairs and laid it on the long altering table, where Giorgio was hunched intently at his sewing machine.
"Signore," he whispered, "someone is here to see you. She says it's an emergency."
Without breaking off from his work or looking up, the man reached out with one hand and took the paper, reading the text. His sewing machine rattled to a stop.
"Send her up immediately," Giorgio commanded
as he tore the paper into tiny shreds. Chapter 82. The massive C-130 transport plane was still ascending as it banked southeast, thundering out across the Adriatic. On board, Robert Langdon was feeling simultaneously cramped and adrift, oppressed by the absence of windows in the aircraft and bewildered by all of the unanswered questions swirling around in his brain. "Your medical condition," Sinsky had told him, "is a bit more complicated than a simple head wound." Langdon's pulse quickened at the thought of what she might tell him, and yet at the moment she was busy discussing containment strategies with the SRS team. Bruder was on the phone nearby, speaking with government agencies about Sienna Brooks, following up on everyone's attempts to locate her.
"Sienna."
Langdon was still trying to make sense of the claim that she was intricately involved in all of this. As the plane leveled out from its ascent, the small man who called himself the provost walked across the cabin and sat down opposite Langdon. He steepled his fingers beneath his chin and pursed his lips.
"Dr. Sinsky asked me to fill you in, make an attempt to bring clarity to your situation."
Langdon wondered what this man could possibly say to make any of this confusion even remotely clear.
"As I began to say earlier," the provost said, "much of this started after my agent, Vianta, pulled you in prematurely. We had no idea how much progress you had made on Dr. Sinsky's behalf, or how much you had shared with her. But we were afraid if she learned the location of the project our client had hired us to protect, she was going to confiscate or destroy it. We had to find it before she did, and so we needed you to work on our behalf, rather than on Sinsky's."
The provost paused, tapping his fingertips together.
"Unfortunately, we had already shown our cards, and you most certainly did not trust us."
"So you shot me in the head?" Langdon replied angrily.
"We came up with a plan to make you trust us."
Langdon felt lost. "How do you make someone trust you after you've kidnapped and interrogated him?" The man shifted uncomfortably now.
"Professor, are you familiar with the family of chemicals known as benzodiazepines?"
Langdon shook his head.
"They are a breed of pharmaceutical that are used for, among other things, the treatment of post-traumatic stress. As you may know, when someone endures a horrific event like a car accident or a sexual assault, the long-term memories can be permanently debilitating. Through the use of benzodiazepines, neuroscientists are now able to treat post-traumatic stress, as it were, before it happens."
Langdon listened in silence, unable to imagine where this conversation might be going.
"When new memories are formed," the provost continued, "those events are stored in your short-term memory for about 48 hours before they migrate to your long-term memory. Using new blends of benzodiazepines, one can easily refresh the short-term memory, essentially deleting its content before those recent memories migrate, so to speak, into long-term memories.
A victim of assault, for example, if administered a benzodiazepine within a few hours after the attack, can have those memories expunged forever, and the trauma never becomes part of her psyche. The only downside is that she loses all recollection of several days of her life. Langdon stared at the tiny man in disbelief.
You gave me amnesia?
The provost let out an apologetic sigh. I'm afraid so. Chemically induced, very safe, but yes, a deletion of your short-term memory. He paused. While you were out, you mumbled something about a plague, which we assumed was on account of your viewing the projector images. We never imagined that Zobrist had created a real plague. He paused. You also kept mumbling a phrase that sounded to us like, very sorry, very sorry. Basari. It must have been all he had figured out about the projector at that point. Cherka Trova. But I thought my amnesia was caused by my head wound. Somebody shot me. The provost shook his head. Nobody shot you, Professor. There was no head wound.
What?
Langdon's fingers groped instinctively for the stitches and the swollen injury on the back of his head.
Then what the hell is this?
He raised his hair to reveal the shaved area. Part of the illusion. We made a small incision in your scalp and then immediately closed it up with stitches. You had to believe you had been attacked.
This isn't a bullet wound?
When you woke up, the provost said, we wanted you to believe that people were trying to kill you, that you were in peril.
People were trying to kill me,
Langdon shouted, his outburst drawing gazes from elsewhere in the plane.
I saw the hospital's Dr. Marconi, gunned down in cold blood.
That's what you saw, the provost said evenly. But that's not what happened. Biantha worked for me. She had a superb skill set for this kind of work.
Killing people? Langdon demanded.
No, the provost said calmly. Pretending to kill people. Langdon stared at the man for a long moment, picturing the gray-bearded doctor with the bushy eyebrows who had collapsed on the floor, blood gushing from his chest. Biantha's gun was loaded with blanks, the provost said. It triggered a radio-controlled squib that detonated a blood pack on Dr. Marconi's chest. He is fine, by the way. Langdon closed his eyes, dumbstruck by what he was hearing.
And the hospital room?
A quickly improvised set, the provost said. Professor, I know this is all very difficult to absorb. We were working quickly and you were groggy, so it didn't need to be perfect. When you woke up, you saw what we wanted you to see. Hospital props, a few actors, and a choreographed attack scene. Langdon was reeling. This is what my company does, the provost said. We're very good at creating illusions.
What about Sienna? Langdon asked, rubbing his eyes.
I needed to make a judgment call, and I chose to work with her. My priority was to protect my client's project from Dr. Sinsky, and Sienna and I shared that desire. To gain your trust, Sienna saved you from the assassin and helped you escape into a rear alleyway. The waiting taxi was also ours, with another radio-controlled squib on the rear windshield to create the final effect as you fled. The taxi took you to an apartment that we had hastily put together.
Sienna's meager apartment, Langdon thought, now understanding why it looked like it had been furnished from a yard sale. And it also explained the convenient coincidence of Sienna's neighbor having clothing that fit him perfectly. The entire thing had been staged. Even the desperate phone call from Sienna's friend at the hospital had been phony.
Sienna is Danikova. When you phoned the U.S. consulate, the provost said, you phoned a number that Sienna looked up for you. It was a number that rang on the Mandatium.
I never reached the consulate.
No, you didn't. Stay where you are, the fake consulate employee had urged him. I'll send someone for you right away.
Then, when Vyantha showed up, Sienna had conveniently spotted her across the street and connected the dots. Robert, your own government is trying to kill you. You can't involve any authorities. Your only hope is to figure out what that projector means. The provost and his mysterious organization, whatever the hell it was, had effectively retasked Langdon to stop working for Sinsky and start working for them. Their illusion was complete. Sienna played me perfectly, he thought, feeling more sad than angry. He had grown fond of her in the short time they'd been together. Most troubling to Langdon was the distressing question of how a soul as bright and warm as Sienna's could give itself over entirely to Zobrist's maniacal solution for overpopulation.
I can tell you without a doubt, Sienna had said to him earlier, that without some kind of drastic change, the end of our species is coming. The mathematics is indisputable.
And the articles about Sienna? Langdon asked, recalling the Shakespeare playbill and the pieces about her staggeringly high IQ. Authentic, the provost replied. The best illusions involve as much of the real world as possible. We didn't have much time to set up, and so Sienna's computer and real-world personal files were almost all we had to work with. You were never really intended to see any of that unless you began doubting her authenticity. Nor use her computer, Langdon said. Yes, that was where we lost control. Sienna never expected Sinsky's SRS team to find the apartment, so when the soldiers moved in, Sienna panicked and had to improvise. She fled on the moped with you, trying to keep the illusion alive. As the entire mission unraveled, I had no choice but to disavow Vyantha, although she broke protocol and pursued you.
She almost killed me, Langdon said, recounting for the provost the showdown in the attic of the Palazzo Vecchio, when Vyantha raised her handgun and aimed point blank at Langdon's chest.
This will only hurt for an instant, but it's my only choice.
Sienna had then darted out and pushed her over the railing, where Vyantha plunged to her death.
The provost sighed audibly, considering what Langdon had just said. I doubt Vyantha was trying to kill you. Her gun fires only blanks. Her only hope of redemption at that point was to take control of you. She probably thought if she shot you with a blank, she could make you understand she was not an assassin after all and that you were caught up in an illusion.
The provost paused, thinking a bit, and then continued.
Whether Sienna actually meant to kill Vyantha or was only trying to interfere with the shot, I won't venture to guess. I'm beginning to realize that I don't know Sienna Brooks as well as I thought.
Me neither, Langdon agreed. Although as he recalled the look of shock and remorse on the young woman's face, he sensed that what she had done to the spike-haired operative was very likely a mistake. Langdon felt unmoored and utterly alone. He turned toward the window, longing to gaze out at the world below, but all he could see was the wall of the fuselage.
I've got to get out of here.
Are you okay? The provost asked, eyeing Langdon with concern.
No, Langdon replied. Not even close.
He'll survive, the provost thought. He's merely trying to process his new reality.
The American professor looked as if he had just been snatched up off the ground by a tornado, spun around, and dumped in a foreign land, leaving him shell-shocked and disoriented. Individuals targeted by the consortium seldom realized the truth behind the staged events they had witnessed. And if they did, the provost certainly was never present to view the aftermath. Today, in addition to the guilt he felt at seeing firsthand Langdon's bewilderment, the man was burdened by an overwhelming sense of responsibility for the current crisis.
I accepted the wrong client, Bertrand Zobrist. I trusted the wrong person, Sienna Brooks.
Now the provost was flying toward the eye of the storm, the epicenter of what might well be a deadly plague that had the potential to wreak havoc across the entire world. If he emerged alive from all this, he suspected that his consortium would never survive the fallout. There would be endless inquiries and accusations.
Is this how it all ends for me?
Chapter 83. I need air, Robert Langdon thought. A vista. Anything. The windowless fuselage felt as if it were closing in around him. Of course, the strange tale of what had actually happened to him today was not helping at all. His brain throbbed with unanswered questions, most of them about Sienna. Strangely, he missed her. She was acting, he reminded himself, using me. Without a word, Langdon left the provost and walked toward the front of the plane. The cockpit door was open, and the natural light streaming through it pulled him like a beacon. Standing in the doorway, undetected by the pilots, Langdon let the sunlight warm his face. The wide open space before him felt like manna from heaven. The clear blue sky looked so peaceful, so permanent. Nothing is permanent, he reminded himself, still struggling to accept the potential catastrophe they were facing. Professor? A quiet voice said behind him, and he turned. Langdon took a startled step backward. Standing before him was Dr. Ferris. The last time Langdon had seen the man, he was writhing on the floor of St. Mark's Basilica, unable to breathe. Now, here he was in the aircraft, leaning against the bulkhead, wearing a baseball cap. His face, covered in calamine lotion, a pasty pink. His chest and torso were heavily bandaged, and his breathing was shallow. If Ferris had the plague, nobody seemed too concerned that he was going to spread it. You're alive? Langdon said, staring at the man. Ferris gave a tired nod. More or less. The man's demeanor had changed dramatically, seeming far more relaxed. But I thought... Langdon stopped. Actually, I'm not sure what to think anymore. Ferris gave him an empathetic smile. You've heard a lot of lies today. I thought I'd take a moment to apologize. As you may have guessed, I don't work for the WHO, and I didn't go to recruit you in Cambridge. Langdon nodded, too tired to be surprised by anything at this point. You work for the provost. I do. He sent me in to offer emergency field support to you and Sienna, and help you escape the SRS team. Then I guess you did your job perfectly, Langdon said, recalling how Ferris had shown up at the baptistry, convinced Langdon he was a WHO employee, and then facilitated his and Sienna's transportation out of Florence and away from Sinsky's team. Obviously you're not a doctor. The man shook his head. No, but I played that part today. My job was to help Sienna keep the illusion going so you could figure out where the projector was pointing. The provost was intent on finding Zobrist's creation so he could protect it from Sinsky. You had no idea it was a plague? Langdon said, still curious about Ferris's strange rash and internal bleeding. Of course not. When you mentioned the plague, I figured it was just a story Sienna had told you to keep you motivated. So I played along. I got us all onto the train to Venice, and then everything changed. How so? The provost saw Zobrist's bizarre video. That could do it. He realized Zobrist was a madman. Exactly. The provost suddenly comprehended what the consortium had been involved in, and he was horrified. He immediately demanded to speak to the person who knew Zobrist best, FS-2080, to see if she knew what Zobrist had done. FS-2080? Sorry. Sienna Brooks. That was the code name she chose for this operation. It's apparently a transhumanist thing, and the provost had no way to reach Sienna except through me. The phone call on the train, Langdon said. Your ailing mother. Well, I obviously couldn't take the provost's call in front of you, so I stepped out. He told me about the video, and I was terrified. He was hoping Sienna had been duped as well. But when I told him you and Sienna had been talking about plagues and seemed to have no intention of breaking off the mission, he knew Sienna and Zobrist were in this together. Sienna instantly became an adversary. He told me to keep him abreast of our position in Venice and that he was sending in a team to detain her. Agent Bruder's team almost had her at St. Mark's Basilica, but she managed to escape. Langdon stared blankly at the floor,
still able to see Sienna's pretty brown eyes gazing down at him before she fled.
I'm so sorry, Robert, for everything. She's tough, the man said. You probably didn't see her attack me at the Basilica.
Attack you?
Yes, when the soldiers entered, I was about to shout out and reveal Sienna's location, but she must have sensed it coming. She drove the heel of her hand straight into the center of my chest.
What?
I didn't know what hit me. Some kind of martial arts move, I guess. Because I was already badly bruised there, the pain was excruciating. It took me 5 minutes to get my wind back. Sienna dragged you out onto the balcony before any witnesses could reveal what had happened.
Stunned, Langdon thought back to the elderly Italian woman who had shouted at Sienna.
L'hai colpito al petto,
and made a forceful motion of her fist on her own chest.
I can't, Sienna had replied. CPR will kill him. Look at his chest.
As Langdon replayed the scene in his mind, he realized just how quickly Sienna Brooks thought on her feet. Sienna had cleverly mistranslated the old woman's Italian.
L'hai colpito al petto was not a suggestion that Sienna apply chest compressions. It was an angry accusation. You punched him in the chest.
With all the chaos of the moment, Langdon had not even noticed. Ferris gave him a pained smile.
As you may have heard, Sienna Brooks is pretty sharp.
Langdon nodded. I've heard.
Sinsky's men brought me back to the Mendacium and bandaged me up. The provost asked me to come along for intel support because I'm the only person other than you who spent time with Sienna today.
Langdon nodded, distracted by the man's rash.
Your face, Langdon asked, and the bruise on your chest. It's not...
The plague?
Ferris laughed and shook his head.
I'm not sure if you've been told yet, but I actually played the part of two doctors today.
I'm sorry?
When I showed up at the baptistry, you said I looked vaguely familiar.
You did, vaguely. Your eyes, I think. You told me that's because you were the one who recruited me in Cambridge.
Langdon paused.
Which I know now is untrue, so...
I looked familiar because we had already met, but not in Cambridge.
The man's eyes probed Langdon's for any hint of recognition.
I was actually the first person you saw when you woke up this morning in the hospital.
Langdon pictured the grim little hospital room. He had been groggy and his eyesight was compromised, so he was pretty certain that the first person he saw when he awoke was a pale, older doctor with bushy eyebrows and a shaggy, graying beard, who spoke only Italian.
No, Langdon said.
Dr. Marconi was the first person I saw when...
Scusi, professore,
the man interrupted with a flawless Italian accent.
Ma non si ricorda di me?
He hunched over like an old man, smoothing back imaginary bushy eyebrows and stroking a non-existent graying beard.
Sono il dottor Marconi.
Langdon's mouth fell open.
Dr. Marconi was
you?
That's why my eyes look familiar. I had never worn a fake beard and eyebrows and, unfortunately, had no idea until it was too late that I was severely allergic to the bonding cement, a latex spirit gum, which left my skin raw and burning. I'm sure you were horrified when you saw me, considering you were on alert for a possible plague.
Langdon could only stare, recalling now how Dr. Marconi had scratched at his beard before Vianta's attack left him lying on the hospital floor, bleeding from the chest.
To make matters worse, the man said, motioning to the bandages around his chest. My squib shifted while the operation was already underway. I couldn't get it back into position in time, and when it detonated, it was at an angle, broke a rib and left me badly bruised. I've been having trouble breathing all day.
And here I thought you had the plague.
The man inhaled deeply and winced.
In fact, I think it's time for me to sit down again.
As he departed, he motioned behind Langdon.
It looks like you have company anyway.
Langdon turned to see Dr. Sinsky striding up the cabin, her long silver hair streaming behind her.
Professor, there you are.
The director of the WHO looked exhausted, and yet, strangely, Langdon detected a fresh glint of hope in her eyes. She's found something.
I'm sorry to have left you,
Sinsky said, arriving beside Langdon.
We've been coordinating and doing some research.
She motioned to the open cockpit door.
I see you're getting some sunlight.
Langdon shrugged. Your plane needs windows. She gave him a compassionate smile.
On the topic of light, I hope the provost was able to shed some for you on recent events?
Yes, although nothing I'm pleased about.
Nor I, she concurred, glancing around to make sure they were alone. Trust me, she whispered. There will be serious ramifications for him and for his organization. I will see to it. At the moment, however, we all need to remain focused on locating that container before it dissolves and the contagion is released.
Or before Sienna gets there and helps it dissolve.
I need to talk to you about the building that houses Dandolo's tomb.
Langdon had been picturing the spectacular structure ever since he realized it was their destination. The Museum of Holy Wisdom.
I just learned something exciting, Sinsky said. We've been on the phone with a local historian, she said. He has no idea why we're inquiring about Dandolo's tomb, of course. But I asked him if he had any idea what was beneath the tomb. And guess what he said? She smiled. Water.
Langdon was surprised. Really?
Yes. It sounds like the building's lower levels are flooded. Over the centuries, the water table beneath the building has risen, submerging at least 2 lower levels. He said there are definitely all kinds of air pockets and partially submerged spaces down there.
My God. Langdon pictured Zobrist's video and the strangely lit underground cavern on whose mossy walls he had seen the faint vertical shadows of pillars. It's a submerged room.
Exactly.
But then, how did Zobrist get down there? Sinsky's eyes twinkled.
That's the amazing part. You won't believe what we just discovered.
At that moment, less than a mile off the coast of Venice, on the slender island known as the Lido, a sleek Cessna Citation Mustang lifted off the tarmac of Nicelli Airport and streaked into the darkening twilight sky. The jet's owner, prominent costume designer Giorgio Venci, was not on board, but he had ordered his pilots to take their attractive young passenger wherever she needed to go. Chapter 84 Night had fallen on the ancient Byzantine capital. All along the banks of the Sea of Marmara, floodlights flickered to life, illuminating a skyline of glistening mosques and slender minarets. This was the hour of the Aksham, and loudspeakers across the city reverberated with the haunting intonations of the Azan, the call to prayer. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but the God. While the faithful scurried to mosques, the rest of the city carried on without a glance. Raucous university students drank beer, businessmen closed deals, merchants hawked spices and rugs, and tourists watched it all in wonder. This was a world divided, a city of opposing forces, religious, secular, ancient, modern, eastern, western. Straddling the geographic boundary between Europe and Asia, this timeless city was quite literally the bridge from the old world to a world that was even older, Istanbul. While no longer the capital of Turkey, it had served over the centuries as the epicenter of 3 distinct empires, the Byzantine, the Roman, and the Ottoman. For this reason, Istanbul was arguably one of the most historically diverse locations on earth. From Topkapi Palace, to the Blue Mosque, to the Castle of the Seven Towers, the city is teeming with folkloric tales of battle, glory, and defeat. Tonight, high in the night sky above its bustling masses, a C-130 transport plane was descending through a gathering storm front on final approach to Ataturk Airport. Inside the cockpit, buckled into the jump seat behind the pilots, Robert Langdon peered out through the windshield, relieved that he had been offered a seat with a view. He was feeling somewhat refreshed after having had something to eat, and then dozing at the rear of the plane for nearly an hour of much-needed rest. Now, off to his right, Langdon could see the lights of Istanbul, a glistening, horn-shaped peninsula
jutting into the blackness of the Sea of Marmara. This was the European side, separated from its Asian sister by a sinuous ribbon of darkness, the Bosporus waterway. At a glance, the Bosporus appeared as a wide gash that severed Istanbul in two. In fact, Langdon knew the channel was the lifeblood of Istanbul's commerce. In addition to providing the city with two coastlines rather than one, the Bosporus enabled ship passage from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, allowing Istanbul to serve as a way station between two worlds. As the plane descended through a layer of mist, Langdon's eyes intently scanned the distant city, trying to catch a glimpse of the massive building they had come to search. The site of Enrico Dandolo's tomb. As it turned out, Enrico Dandolo, the treacherous Doge of Venice, had not been buried in Venice. Rather, his remains had been interred in the heart of the stronghold he had conquered in 1202, the sprawling city beneath them. Fittingly, Dandolo had been laid to rest in the most spectacular shrine his captured city had to offer, a building that to this day remained the crown jewel of the region, Hagia Sophia. Originally built in AD 360, Hagia Sophia had served as an Eastern Orthodox cathedral until 1204, when Enrico Dandolo and the Fourth Crusade conquered the city and turned it into a Catholic church. Later, in the 15th century, following the conquest of Constantinople by Fatih Sultan Mehmed, it had become a mosque, remaining an Islamic house of worship until 1935, when the building was secularized and became a museum. A gilded museon of holy wisdom, Langdon thought. Not only was Hagia Sophia adorned with more gold tile than St. Mark's, its name, Hagia Sophia, literally meant holy wisdom. Langdon pictured the colossal building and tried to fathom the fact that somewhere beneath it, a darkened lagoon contained a tethered, undulating sack, hovering underwater, slowly dissolving and preparing to release its contents. Langdon prayed they were not too late.
The building's lower levels are flooded, Sinsky had announced earlier in the flight, excitedly motioning for Langdon to follow her back to her work area. You won't believe what we just discovered. Have you ever heard of a documentary film director named Göksel Gülensoy?
Langdon shook his head.
While I was researching Hagia Sophia, Sinsky explained, I discovered that a film had been made about it, a documentary made by Gülensoy a few years back.
Dozens of films have been made about Hagia Sophia.
Yes, she said, arriving at her work area. But none like this.
She spun her laptop so he could see it.
Read this.
Langdon sat down and eyed the article, a composite of various news sources, including the Hurriyet Daily News, discussing Gülensoy's newest film, In the Depths of Hagia Sophia. As Langdon began to read, he immediately realized why Sinsky was excited. The first two words alone made Langdon glance up at her in surprise. Scuba diving?
I know, she said. Just read.
Langdon turned his eyes back to the article. Scuba diving beneath Hagia Sophia. Documentary filmmaker Göksel Gülensoy and his exploratory scuba team have located remote flooded basins lying hundreds of feet beneath Istanbul's heavily touristed religious structure. In the process, they discovered numerous architectural wonders, including the 800-year-old submerged graves of martyred children, as well as submerged tunnels connecting Hagia Sophia to Topkapi Palace, Tekfur Palace, and the rumored subterranean extensions of the Anemis dungeons. I believe what is beneath Hagia Sophia is much more exciting than what is above the surface, Gülensoy explained, describing how he had been inspired to make the film after seeing an old photograph of researchers examining the foundations of Hagia Sophia by boat, paddling through a large, partially submerged hall.
You've obviously found the right building, Sinsky exclaimed, and it sounds like there are huge pockets of navigable space beneath that building, many of them accessible without scuba gear, which may also explain what we're seeing in Zobrist's video.
Agent Bruder stood behind them, studying the laptop screen.
It also sounds like the waterways beneath the building spider outward to all kinds of other areas. If that Solublon bag dissolves before we arrive, there will be no way to stop the contents from spreading.
The contents? Langdon ventured. Do you have any idea what it is? I mean, exactly? I know we're dealing with a pathogen, but...
We've been analyzing the footage, Bruder said, which suggests that it's indeed biological rather than chemical. That is to say, something living. Considering the small amount in the bag, we assume it's highly contagious and has the ability to replicate. Whether it's a waterborne contagion like a bacterium, or whether it has the potential to go airborne like a virus once it's released, we are not sure, but either is possible.
Sinsky said, We're now gathering data on water table temperatures in the area, trying to assess what kinds of contagious substances might thrive in those subterranean areas. But Zobrist was exceptionally talented and easily could have engineered something with unique capabilities. And I have to suspect that there was a reason Zobrist chose this location.
Bruder gave a resigned nod and quickly relayed his assessment of the unusual dispersal mechanism, the submerged Solublon bag, the simple brilliance of which was just starting to dawn on them all. By suspending the bag underground and underwater, Zobrist had created an exceptionally stable incubation environment, one with consistent water temperature, no solar radiation, a kinetic buffer, and total privacy. By choosing a bag of the correct durability, Zobrist could leave the contagion unattended to mature for a specific duration before it self-released on schedule, even if Zobrist never returned to the site. The sudden jolt of the plane touching down jarred Langdon back to his jump seat in the cockpit. The pilots braked hard and then taxied to a remote hangar where they brought the massive plane to a stop. Langdon half expected to be greeted by an army of WHO employees in hazmat suits. Strangely, the only party awaiting their arrival was the driver of a large white van that bore the emblem of a bright red equal-armed cross. The Red Cross is here? Langdon looked again, realizing it was the other entity that used the Red Cross, the Swiss Embassy. He unbuckled and located Sinsky as everyone prepared to deplane. Where is everyone? Langdon demanded. The WHO team? The Turkish authorities? Is everyone already over at Hagia Sophia? Sinsky gave him an uneasy glance.
Actually, she explained, we have decided against alerting local authorities. We already have the ECDC's finest SRS team with us, and it seems preferable to keep this a quiet operation for the moment, rather than creating a possible widespread panic.
Nearby, Langdon could see Bruder and his team zipping up large black duffel bags that contained all kinds of hazmat gear, biosuits, respirators, and electronic detection equipment. Bruder heaved his bag over his shoulder and came over.
We're a go. We'll enter the building, find Dandolo's tomb, listen for water as the poem suggests, and then my team and I will reassess and decide whether to call in other authorities for support.
Langdon already saw problems with the plan. Hagia Sophia closes at sunset, so without local authorities, we can't even get in.
We're fine, Sinsky said. I have a contact in the Swiss Embassy who contacted the Hagia Sophia Museum curator and asked for a private VIP tour as soon as we arrive. The curator agreed.
Langdon almost laughed out loud. A VIP tour for the director of the World Health Organization and an army of soldiers carrying hazmat duffels? You don't think that might raise a few eyebrows?
The SRS team and gear will stay in the car, while Bruder, you, and I assess the situation, Sinsky said. Also, for the record, I'm not the VIP. You are.
I beg your pardon?
We told the museum that a famous American professor had flown in with a research team to write an article on the symbols of Hagia Sophia, but their plane was delayed 5 hours, and he missed his window to see the building. Since he and his team were leaving tomorrow morning, we were hoping...
Okay, Langdon said. I get the gist.
The museum is sending an employee to meet us there personally. As it turns out, he's a big fan of your writings on Islamic art.
Sinsky gave him a tired smile, clearly trying to look optimistic.
We've been assured that you'll have access to every corner of the building.
And more important, Bruder declared, we'll have the entire place to ourselves. Chapter 85. Robert Langdon gazed blankly out the window of the van as it sped along the waterfront highway connecting Ataturk Airport to the center of Istanbul. The Swiss officials had somehow facilitated a modified customs process, and Langdon, Sinsky, and the others in the group had been en route in a matter of minutes. Sinsky had ordered the provost and Ferris to remain aboard the C-130 with several WHO staff members and to continue trying to track the whereabouts of Sienna Brooks. While nobody truly believed Sienna could reach Istanbul in time, there were fears she might phone one of Zobrist's disciples in Turkey and ask for assistance in realizing Zobrist's delusional plan before Sinsky's team could interfere. Would Sienna really commit mass murder? Langdon was still struggling to accept all that had happened today. It pained him to do so, but he was forced to accept the truth. You never knew her, Robert. She played you. A light rain had begun to fall over the city, and Langdon felt suddenly weary as he listened to the repetitive swish of the windshield wipers.
To his right, out on the Sea of Marmara, he could see the running lights of luxury yachts and massive tankers powering to and from the city port up ahead. All along the waterfront, illuminated minarets rose slender and elegant above their domed mosques, silent reminders that while Istanbul was a modern secular city, its core was grounded in religion.
Langdon had always found this 10-mile strip of highway one of the prettiest drives in Europe. A perfect example of Istanbul's clash of old and new, the road followed part of Constantine's Wall, which had been built more than 16 centuries before the birth of the man for whom this avenue was now named, John F. Kennedy. The U.S. president had been a great admirer of Kemal Atatürk's vision for a Turkish republic springing from the ashes of a fallen empire. Providing unparalleled views of the sea, Kennedy Avenue wound through spectacular groves and historic parks, past the harbor in Yenikapi, and eventually threaded its way between the city limits and the Strait of Bosporus, where it continued northward all the way around the Golden Horn. There, high above the city, rose the Ottoman stronghold of Topkapi Palace. With its strategic view of the Bosporus waterway, the palace was a favorite among tourists, who visited to admire both the vistas and the staggering collection of Ottoman treasure that included the cloak and sword said to have belonged to the Prophet Muhammad himself. We won't be going that far, Langdon knew, picturing their destination, Hagia Sophia, which rose out of the city center not far ahead. As they pulled off Kennedy Avenue and began snaking into the densely populated city, Langdon stared out at the crowds of people on the streets and sidewalks and felt haunted by the day's conversations. Overpopulation, the plague, Zobrist's twisted aspirations. Even though Langdon had understood all along exactly where this SRS mission was headed, he had not fully processed it until this moment. We are going to ground zero. He pictured the slowly dissolving bag of yellow-brown fluid and wondered how he had let himself get into this position. The strange poem that Langdon and Sienna had unveiled on the back of Dante's death mask had eventually guided him here, to Istanbul. Langdon had directed the SRS team to Hagia Sophia and knew there would be more to do once they arrived. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom, and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here, in the darkness, the Thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars. Langdon again felt troubled to know that the final canto of Dante's Inferno ended in a nearly identical scene. After a long descent through the underworld, Dante and Virgil reach the lowest point of hell. Here, with no way out, they hear the sounds of trickling water running through stones beneath them, and they follow the rivulet through cracks and crevices, ultimately
finding safety.
Dante wrote, "A place is there below, which not by sight is known, but by the sound of a rivulet, which descends along the hollow of a rock. And by that hidden way, my guide and I did enter, to return to the fair world."
Dante's scene had clearly been the inspiration for Zobrist's poem, although in this case, it seemed Zobrist had flipped everything upside down. Langdon and the others would indeed be following the sounds of trickling water. But unlike Dante, they would not be heading away from the inferno, but directly into it. As the van maneuvered through tighter streets and more densely populated neighborhoods, Langdon began to grasp the perverse logic that had led Zobrist to choose downtown Istanbul as the epicenter of a pandemic. East meets west, the crossroads of the world. Istanbul had, at numerous times in history, succumbed to deadly plagues that killed off enormous portions of its population. In fact, during the final phase of the Black Death, this very city had been called the plague hub of the empire, and the disease was said to have killed more than 10,000 residents a day. Several famous Ottoman paintings depicted townspeople desperately digging plague pits to bury mounds of corpses in the nearby fields of Taksim. Langdon hoped Karl Marx was wrong when he said, "History repeats itself." All along the rainy streets, unsuspecting souls were bustling about their evening's business. A pretty Turkish woman called her children in to dinner. Two old men shared a drink at an outdoor cafe. A well-dressed couple walked hand in hand beneath an umbrella, and a tuxedoed man leaped off a bus and ran down the street, sheltering his violin case beneath his jacket, apparently late for a concert. Langdon found himself studying the faces around him, trying to imagine the intricacies of each person's life. The masses are made up of individuals. He closed his eyes, turning from the window and trying to abandon the morbid turn his thoughts had taken. But the damage was done. In the darkness of his mind, an unwanted image materialized. The desolate landscape of Bruegel's Triumph of Death, a hideous panorama of pestilence, misery, and torture, laying ruin to a seaside city. The van turned to the right onto Torun Avenue, and for a moment Langdon thought they had arrived at their destination. On his left, rising out of the mist, a great mosque appeared. But it was not Hagia Sophia. The Blue Mosque, he quickly realized, spotting the building's six fluted, pencil-shaped minarets, which had multiple Şerefe balconies and climbed skyward to end in piercing spires. Langdon had once read that the exotic, fairy-tale quality of the Blue Mosque's balconied minarets had inspired the design for Cinderella's iconic castle at Disney World. The Blue Mosque drew its name from the dazzling sea of blue tiles that adorned its interior walls. "We're close," Langdon thought, as the van sped onward, turning on to Gabasakal Avenue and running along the expansive plaza of Sultanahmet Park, which was situated halfway between the Blue Mosque and Hagia Sophia, and famous for its views of both. Langdon squinted through the rain-swept windshield, searching the horizon for the outline of Hagia Sophia, but the rain and headlights made visibility difficult. Worse still, traffic along the avenue seemed to have stopped. Up ahead, Langdon saw nothing but a line of glowing brake lights. "An event of some sort," the driver announced. "A concert, I think. It may be faster on foot." "How far?" Sinsky demanded. "Just through the park here. 3 minutes. Very safe." Sinsky nodded to Bruder and then turned to the SRS team.
"Stay in the van. Get as close as you can to the building. Agent Bruder will be in touch very soon."
With that, Sinsky, Bruder, and Langdon jumped out of the van into the street and headed across the park. The broad-leaved trees in Sultanahmet Park offered a bit of cover from the worsening weather as the group hurried along its canopied paths. The walkways were dotted with signage directing visitors to the park's many attractions: an Egyptian obelisk from Luxor, the serpent column from the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, and the Million Column that once served as the point zero from which all distances were measured in the Byzantine Empire. Finally, they emerged from the trees at the foot of a circular reflecting pool that marked the center of the park. Langdon stepped into the opening and raised his eyes to the east. Hagia Sophia. Not so much a building as a mountain. Glistening in the rain, the colossal silhouette of Hagia Sophia appeared to be a city unto itself. Its central dome, impossibly broad and ribbed in silver gray, seemed to rest upon a conglomeration of other domed buildings that had been piled up around it. Four towering minarets, each with a single balcony and a silver-gray spire, rose from the corners of the building. So far from the central dome that one could barely determine that they were part of a single structure. Sinsky and Bruder, who until this point had been maintaining a steady, focused jog, both pulled up suddenly, their eyes craning upward, upward, as their minds struggled to absorb the full height and breadth of the structure looming before them. Dear God. Bruder let out a soft groan of disbelief. We're going to be searching that?